mornings. I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up today, reflections on the legacy of Pope Francis, his impact on the papacy and the Catholic Church, with Father Adam Hertzfeld of St. Michael the Archangel Parish. Also this morning, protecting your puppy from parvo, what pet owners need to know about the canine parvovirus. And we have details on upcoming programs and events at the Findlay-Hancock County Public Library. Sarah Clevedens will be here to tell us what's happening. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Wednesday, April 23rd, 2025. We'll wager on anything in this country. We will wager on anything. After the passing of Pope Francis, they're already taking bets on who will be the next pope. They're actually offering odds on who the next pope will be. Odds Checker lists Pietro Parolin as the favorite. At plus 350. Now, if you're not familiar with gambling parlance, that means if you would wager $100 and Cardinal Parolin is selected, you would win $350, plus 350. Now, wager $100 to win $350. Cardinal Luis Antonio Tagle, is that how you pronounce it? Tagle, T-A-G-L-E. He is the second favorite among the cardinals to be the next pope. It will be a little while yet before the conclave to choose the next pope, who must receive 2/3 of the vote from all cardinals under the age of 80 at the conclave. So there is some time, so those odds may change. I would be interested to see who the top American contender, this, it seems weird to say that, the top American contender would be on the odds makers list of potential new popes. We will gamble on anything. And it's not just in this country. Globally, this is apparently a big deal. It's, I don't know, it's weird. That is just weird. So I have to apologize today. I'm not feeling full strength today. You know how the past week and a half, it's been cold weather, warm weather, cold weather, warm weather. It always gets me this time of year when we get this transition of really nice warm weather followed by a day or two of chillier weather. It's, my sinuses have been playing a number on me. I feel fine other than just my sinuses have... they are at once, you know, I'm all stuffed up and then they're draining and then it's, yeah, I'm going through that. It's not allergies. I'm not, as far as I know, I'm not allergic to anything. It's just one of those things that happens to me every, so I just mention it because if I feel a little off my game today, that is why. I'm just, my sinuses are draining and it's just those days. I just want to bring it up. I know it's pleasant, right? Yeah. By the way, speaking of wagering on things, Wallet Hub is out with their list of the most gambling-addicted states in the United States. And in the what is maybe the least surprising result of any Wallet Hub ranking ever compiled, Nevada is number one. Residents in Nevada are the most gambling-addicted in the country. Although it is a bit of a surprise, because typically the biggest gamblers in the state of Ohio are the two, or in the state of Nevada rather, are the tourists, not the, you wouldn't think the locals, because they're around it all the time. And I mean, if you are gambling addicted, the last place you would want to live is Nevada. You know what I mean? But they are, in fact, the most gambling addicted in the country, according to this new report by Wallet Hub, comparing all 50 states based on metrics like the number of casinos, the number of adults with gambling disorders, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Equally unsurprising as Nevada being number one, Utah is the bottom of the list, the least gambling addicted state, is Utah. Alaska is second for lowest gambling addiction. South Dakota came in second for most addicted. So at the top, it's Nevada and South Dakota. At the bottom, it's Utah and Alaska. Ohio, by the way, is 32nd. So that's not too bad, actually. I mean, we like to wager every now and then, but not necessarily gambling addicted. So that is positive. Just kind of interesting. And again, maybe the least surprising information you will hear this morning. Couple of other items. Among the first things you need to know this morning, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day. You remember a couple of weeks ago, I think we mentioned this, that at Disney, they have a special promotion trying to attract more families to the Disney resorts with half-price kids tickets. For the summer of 2025, Disney is offering kids tickets at half price. And now, with this most recent announcement, they are helping families save even more money, this time on dining plans. Starting in 2026, families who are booking a Walt Disney Travel Company package can get a free dining plan for kids between the ages of 3 and 9. To qualify, you have to stay at a Disney Resorts hotel, and you have to purchase a dining plan for each guest age 10 and up. But if you do that, you can get either a Disney dining plan for one quick service meal, one table service meal, one snack, and one non-alcoholic drink, and a resort refillable drink mug. The quick service dining plan includes two quick service meals. There's not a sit-down meal. One snack, non-alcoholic drink, and a resort refillable drink mug. So, and they are free for kids between the ages of 3 and 9. The free kids offer builds on Disney's recent push to make trips more budget-friendly for families. We mentioned the half-price tickets for kids in the summer of 2025. That runs from May 27th to September 20th. And then in 2026, they'll pick up with the free dining deals. So, if you're planning on visiting Disney with your kids, I'm going to try and make it a little bit more affordable anyway. So, that is good news. And finally, here, among the first things that you need to know this morning, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day. We have a loneliness epidemic in this country. American adults are hitting peak loneliness many years before retirement. And that is unique to the United States, according to a new study. They looked at more than 64,000 adults age 50 and over across 29 different countries. And the relationship where middle-aged adults had a higher level of loneliness is very important, according to Dr. Robin Richardson, the primary author of the study and assistant professor at the Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University. The United States and the Netherlands are the only two countries where loneliness peaked in middle age rather than in seniors. According to the study, which was published this week in the medical journal Aging and Mental Health. Now, you would think, and I think the common belief is that loneliness sets in when we retire and we no longer have those interactions with our coworkers on a daily basis. And yes, that does play a role, but many other factors besides work status play into this. Including being unmarried. We have more unmarried folks in middle age these days. Depression, actual diagnosed depression. We have mental health issues in this country. Having poor self-rated health, if we are in poor health, that contributes to loneliness. The advisory suggested looking for ways to help others. whether family or friends, or even strangers within the community. Helping others is a way to counter feelings of isolation and loneliness. So if you know someone who kind of falls into this category, recommend that they join a group, group activities like workout classes or groups based around a shared interest or hobby, or even religious groups. While spending quality time with others, do your best to limit distractions. This is very important, too. While spending quality time with others, and there's times where you are able to interact with other human beings, do your best to limit distractions, like checking your phone, and make time every day to connect with someone you care about. Some of the advice that they offer for those who are in middle age to stave off loneliness. Kind of interesting. It's not always those who are retired or older seniors who deal with loneliness. It actually is quite prevalent in middle age, according to this research. Interesting there. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Wednesday morning started.
I'm Jay Fox on the Ohio News Network. A federal judge in Columbus has ordered both Homeland Security and Immigration and Customs Enforcement to reinstate the F-1 student visa of Prasanna Origanti, an agricultural engineering student at The Ohio State University. The ruling also prohibits those agencies from detaining and deporting her. The Columbus Dispatch reports that last week, the student filed a federal civil rights lawsuit against those agencies. Origanti is one of several students at OSU facing similar circumstances. Other states have had similar rulings in these types of cases. In Southwest Ohio last week, James River Phillips was charged with possession of an unregistered explosive device. Now he faces federal bomb-making charges. ONN's Jared Allen has more.
The attorney claims his client set off explosive devices for fun and did it on private property with permission from the property owner. Attorney Scott Croswell says Phillips destroyed a car, a tractor, and a television, all he says were broken prior to being exploded. Crosley offered those explanations on his client's behalf during a court hearing Tuesday in Cincinnati.
In Northeast Ohio, Lieutenant George Hughes of the Cuyahoga County Sheriff's Office has been on paid leave now for over 2 years while being investigated for the alleged groping of a corrections officer. While on leave, he's been paid almost $195,000. For the Ohio News Network, I'm Jay Fox.
Our cover story this morning is the big story globally this week, the passing of Pope Francis and reflections on his legacy, his impact on the papacy and on the Catholic Church itself. Father Adam Hertzfeld, St. Michael the Archangel Parish, is with us this morning. Father, thanks very much for taking the time.
We appreciate it. Thanks, Chris, for having me on.
He's referred to as the People's Pope, and his legacy is quite different than his predecessors. He really was very much the People's Pope.
I agree. Pope Benedict, his immediate predecessor, was a very shy man, very intelligent, brilliant theologically, but kind of shy. I had the chance to meet with him once, and yeah, that shy aspect came out even just in a one-on-one. Pope Francis, on the other hand, more effusive, much more, you could almost say, telegenic, appealed to people across a wide variety.
He had that. He seemed to have that ability to connect with really anyone in just about any situation. He also, and I thought one of the things that maybe helped him connect with the masses was his ability to speak to contemporary issues in society.
Definitely. So he, you could say one of his virtues was empathy. And so he could empathize very much with those who suffered or struggled in any way. And that was seen in his emphasis on the periphery, people on the margins, people who maybe felt neglected by the rest of society. Yeah. So he was able to connect there. And I think most of us like it when somebody who's in a leadership position can empathize with those who are hurting.
Well, and that, as someone who is not Catholic myself, I'm curious, was that felt as kind of a trickle-down effect within congregation, even among those who, you know, never met the Pope, or it's, I mean, did you see that kind of reinvigoration in the church with his leadership?
I think the emphasis on, we could call it like the biblical works of mercy. Yes, he had several initiatives over those 12 years where he was really emphasizing those works of mercy, mm-hmm. and that was picked up by many. You know, you can't hardly miss it mm-hmm. with the Pope.
Yeah. He also, though, broached some subjects that have been notoriously difficult for the church to deal with, things like homosexuality and things like intersection of science and theology, things of that nature, some hot button political issues in terms of immigration and so on, which were not always welcome necessarily by some other leaders within the church. So it's a bit of a complicated legacy,
right? As a communicator, he sort of shot from the hip at times, and that made it difficult to figure out exactly what is he saying. And, I would also say one of his strengths was not doctrine. It was not, you know, a deep understanding of the teaching of the church. He was moved more by the heart than by the intellect,
mm-hmm.
And so that came out.
Did that make for some interesting conversations? Again, because all of this trickles down to right. The parish level, and I'm sure people will come to you and say, well, what does this mean? What is, you know, when the Pope says this, that, or the other thing?
Yeah, many people would struggle with that, and I found two things. One, that when I would go back to the source that they were struggling with, most often the Pope was misquoted or misunderstood. Mm-hmm. That happened many a times.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing I would say is that look, what the Pope says in the middle of the night on an airplane is not the teaching of the church. If you want the teaching, go to the catechism.
But at the same time, it, again, going back to the message of mercy, mm-hmm. it did sort of open the door for a more merciful stance on some of these things that are quite difficult, again, for Catholics
right.
to reconcile.
Exactly.
So.
Yeah, I think it's clearly the teaching of the church all the way back to Christ himself, that we love the sinner, but we hate the sin.
Mm-hmm.
And so Pope Francis had an ability to sort of help us to remind ourselves of that loving the sinner is mm-hmm. there. I think Pharisaism is hating the sinner and hating the sin.
Yeah.
It's like, well,
yeah.
You can't do that. That's not at all Christ-like.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the other thing that Pope Francis was very good at, and again, as someone who is not Catholic myself, one of the things that I noticed the most about his leadership is that he was uniquely able to, and it seemed at times very deliberate about reaching out to those of other faiths, being Jewish or Muslim or even other Christian faiths.
Mm-hmm. That is true. And there was one instance, for example, that caused a lot of confusion when he was speaking to young people in Singapore, where he said, all religions lead to God. And many people got very upset by that. One quote I read in the press said, all religions lead equally to God. Well, then I looked up what he actually said. He never mm-hmm. said equally to God.
Yeah.
There is a primacy in Christianity. You know, Christ is the yeah. fullness of God's word to humanity.
Yeah.
But any religion that's a true religion is pointing to God. So, mm-hmm. you know, the statement that he made was correct.
Yeah. Big shoes to fill mm-hmm. for whoever will be next in line. Obviously, you've never been Pope, so I ask you, how difficult will that be? But can you imagine how difficult that would be to step into that role, given everything that we've just talked about Pope Francis's legacy?
Somebody asked me just the other day, are there cardinals that like are jockeying to be Pope? I said, probably. I said, yeah. These are very competent individuals running very complicated archdioceses throughout the world.
Mm-hmm.
When you're good at something, you get the feeling sometimes that, hey, you know what? I think I could do that.
Yeah.
I could do it even pretty good.
What drives people to be CEOs of companies
exactly.
or the president of the United States or whatever.
Yeah.
These are humans yep. who naturally want, you know, I'm sure, to move up.
Yep, and to improve upon what they see. So mm-hmm. the next guy, I think from the standpoint of the teaching of the church, there'll be some clarifications that have to take place. But the church will never change her stance on a preferential option for the poor and for those who feel alienated or distant from God. That's our whole point of existence.
Yeah. I won't ask who you think might be the next pope. There are any number of possibilities, and you know, trying to predict that is almost impossible. Mm-hmm. I am curious, is there any... Do you see any possibility that there might be an American pope in, at, if not this time around, in the near future, sometime?
I don't foresee it in my lifetime, and I think it's simply much of the world views the U.S. As very wealthy and sort of privileged, and maybe therefore an American pope might not be able to empathize with the poorest of the poor. So I think that might play into it, but you never know. A superstar personality, someone who, you know, stands out head and shoulders above the rest could do that. I just don't see that now.
Yeah, I was reading some of those who have speculated about who might be in the running or possibly front runners for the job, for the position. And there are some interesting possibilities, perhaps a French pope, perhaps somebody from, I think, Belgium. There's a cardinal.
Holland, the Holland. Guy from Holland, and the guy from Hungary, the cardinal from Hungary.
That was the other other one. Yeah, so there are an awful lot of... For those who are not familiar, kind of take us through the timeline. What happens next at this point? Obviously, we go through the period of mourning. The funeral for Pope Francis is on Saturday. And then what happens next?
Mm-hmm. It's the mourning is simultaneous with the preparations for the conclave. My understanding is that the cardinals, those who were able to gather already yesterday morning, have done so. And they begin to, you know, set the preliminary schedule.
Mm-hmm.
And they also begin to get to know one another. One of the, you could say, criticisms of Pope Francis is that he didn't call the cardinals together very often. And because they're from far-flung places throughout the globe, many of them don't know each other. And
interesting.
So they have to start to get to know each other because one of from among their group is going to be the next pope.
Mm-hmm.
After the funeral, then they will have... they will have conferences that they're confidential, but they're not as confidential as the voting process.
Mm-hmm.
They'll move from those conferences into the Sistine Chapel, where they'll be sequestered until they produce a pope.
Mm. So we will certainly watch very closely and pray for guidance for these leaders of the Catholic Church as they select the next leader. And again, Father Adam Hertzfeld from Findlay St. Michael the Archangel Parish with us this morning, reflections on Pope Francis. Father Adam, thanks very much for dropping by. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Chris.
Well, today marks National Parvo Awareness Day. It is designated to raise awareness about canine parvovirus, which is an often fatal puppy disease that affects over 300,000 dogs each year. Elanco Animal Health has on its website a map tracking the reported cases, and while there has only been one so far this year in Hancock County, that does not necessarily mean that your pup is not at risk. So joining us this morning is Dr. Chris George, veterinarian and infectious disease specialist with Elanco. What is, first of all, let's start with the very basics here. What is parvovirus, and what are the signs and symptoms of this?
Well, thank you, Chris, for having me and helping to spread the awareness of parvovirus. Canine parvovirus is one of, as you mentioned, one of the most common, highly contagious, and potentially fatal viruses of dogs. And it can occur in dogs of any age, but we most commonly see it in our young or unvaccinated dogs. So think puppies, ages 6 weeks to 6 months of age, are our most vulnerable or most commonly affected dogs. It is a gastrointestinal or GI virus. So the most common symptoms are associated with the intestinal tract. So things like vomiting, loss of appetite, diarrhea, or lethargy, which is just generally acting sick or tired.
So an important distinction, because I was going to ask if this is exclusively a puppy disease, and you say it is not. But it's typically because they haven't built up a strong immune system yet. They haven't had their vaccinations, that kind of thing. Is that why you see it more in puppies?
You are spot on. Yeah. So our puppies don't have a mature immune system yet. So they have that weaker immune system. And you're exactly right. They haven't had time to receive their puppy vaccines to be protected. So we do have very highly effective vaccines against canine parvovirus to help prevent the disease. That's why we see it less commonly in our older patients, because they're typically well vaccinated.
Mm-hmm.
But even older dogs that are unvaccinated or have other diseases that suppress their immune system absolutely are susceptible to parvovirus.
Yeah, I was going to mention, so for dog owners who are not up on their vaccines, this is something that we are talking to you as well. How is this spread?
It's spread through either direct or indirect contact with contaminated feces. So a dog doesn't necessarily have to go and eat another dog's pile of poop, which I know a lot of our dogs will do that. But it can be something as simple as walking through a contaminated area and then licking their paws. Or you and I can actually spread the virus as well. It can get on our shoes, our clothes, our hands. And when our pets come and lick us, we can spread the virus that way as well. So it's a very hardy virus, lives in the environment for a year or potentially longer. And that's where if your pet is unvaccinated or you have that new family member, that vulnerable little puppy, try and avoid the more communal areas, things like dog parks or doggy daycares, where we have that higher population of dogs and increased exposure risk.
I was going to ask, obviously, vaccinating dogs is going to be critically important for this. But aside from that, what are some of the other ways to protect your dogs? Because as you were saying, this is a pretty hearty virus, and it's something that is highly contagious.
Yeah, so I can't understate the importance of vaccines anymore, and you nailed it. That's our best tool at preventing disease. Next is being a good citizen, right? Scoop your poop. Make sure you pick up after your dogs to help prevent the spread of parvovirus. The less poop that's out there, the less parvo that'll be out there.
Right.
And then you mentioned it in the intro. Elanco has come out with a Parvo Track. It's a new tool that helps identify outbreaks of canine parvovirus. And your audience can find that on stopparvo.com, where they can sign up for alerts to be notified if there is an outbreak of parvovirus in their area. They can also report cases to help notify everyone in the community that, hey, parvovirus is in our backyard. So you had mentioned there's been one case reported in your area, but the key word there is report it.
Yeah.
So this is not a mandatory reporting system. It's voluntary. So we're really relying on our pet parents and our veterinarians to report these cases so that everyone is aware of if there is a potential outbreak, and hence the need for National Parvo Awareness Day to, again, spread that awareness that parvovirus is out there. And this is the time of year that we'll start to see that those outbreaks in the spring into summer.
You make such a good point that this is just the number of reported cases. There may very well be additional cases that haven't been reported. And as we mentioned, given how contagious this is, it doesn't take many to create an outbreak.
You're absolutely right, Chris.
So what are the treatment options? As we mentioned, this can be potentially fatal. Are there treatment options should a dog contract the canine parvovirus?
Historically, there has been no targeted treatment for canine parvovirus. So historically, our treatment has been geared at treating the symptoms while allowing the virus to just simply run its course.
Mm-hmm.
So that typically involves intensive care, ICU care in a veterinary hospital, where we use things like IV fluids to keep them hydrated, anti-vomiting medications, again, just symptomatic care. Fortunately, Elanco has come out with some recent innovation in the form of canine parvovirus monoclonal antibody, or CPMA for short. It's the first and only conditionally approved treatment that targets canine parvovirus. So we're actually treating the underlying disease and not just another symptom. And it can help get puppies feeling better faster and ultimately home quicker.
So the second part of the message is that if you spot the symptoms or you believe that your dog, particularly puppies, might have been exposed, you don't want to waste any time to reach out to your veterinarian and find out if this is something that, you know, needs to be addressed.
Absolutely, Chris. Yeah, I feel like there's three main points here. First is prevention. This is a preventable disease, so making sure our dogs are up to date on vaccines and, mm-hmm. and get them vaccinated as puppies. Two is awareness. As you just mentioned, look out for those signs and symptoms. And if your dog does come down with any of those signs or symptoms, get them checked as soon as possible. And then lastly is knowing that there is now a targeted treatment for canine parvovirus. So yeah. If they do test positive, ask your vet about CPMA, as that could be a great treatment option for your dog.
Again, Dr. Chris George is veterinarian and infectious disease specialist at Elanco Animal Health. You mentioned the website where folks can learn more. Where do we find that?
Yes, it's stopparvo.com, and parvo is P-A-R-V-O, stopparvo.com.
Good information for pet owners to know this morning. Dr. George, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris.
This is Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
We interrupt this program to bring you a broken news alert.
Story out of New Jersey. I'm not sure exactly where in New Jersey this was. John Carpenter is this guy's name. He parked his sports car, 2011 Camaro 2SS, outside a Costco while getting gas. So he's at Costco. He's getting gas. He got his sports car. There is 2011 Camaro, beloved sports car. And sure enough, the wind kicks up, and two shopping carts go flying past the right side of his car from the wind. His wife said, "Look out! Here come the shopping carts." No sooner did he have the two shopping carts graze the side of his car, a third came up from behind me that I did not see, he said, which slammed into the driver's front quarter panel of the car, denting his prized sports car, although luckily it did not damage the paint. Mr. Carpenter had to pay over $1,000 to have it fixed, and then he found out that Costco would not cover the cost of the repair. I mean, I'm not going to do that. That's when the story got out, though. This is what is funny to me. When the story got out, a Costco claims representative contacted Mr. Carpenter and offered him a $500 gift card on the condition that he signed a non-disclosure agreement and not talk about the case any further. They got Costco to cover half the cost in the form of a gift card, but he had to sign an NDA. What? What is there something that Costco is really concerned about? It happens. The wind comes up. It blew a cart across the parking lot. They just, I guess, don't want the negative publicity. So they made him sign an NDA, not talk about it anymore. Just dented the front quarter panel of his car. So. Could have been a lot worse. This another vehicle story in Japan. A famous music producer in Japan, Hankun is his name. I guess he goes by that name. He's a music producer in Japan, saved for 10 years to buy his dream car, a Ferrari 458 Spider. Nice car. However, after owning it for all of 1 hour, the car went up in flames. He shared his story on social media, and the story has gone viral in Japan. After receiving the car, he took it for a drive, but the vehicle soon started smoking. He pulled over, called the fire department. By the time they arrived, the car had gone up in flames. He spent 43 million yen, or roughly $306,000, and all he has left of his car is a photo. One single photo. All things considered, he was happy that no one was hurt. The cause of the fire has yet to be determined. Wow. $300,000. He had it for 1 hour and it burst into flames. Man. Now all of a sudden, the guy who got his car dented by a shopping cart in the parking lot Costco doesn't seem so bad, does it? Yeah. Let's see. What else is going on? A couple of other stories. Kind of a light day in the broken news today, but this is kind of interesting. Talk about stories going viral. This is a sixth grader in Florida who entered some unique research in his school's science fair recently. And it has now gone viral, his science fair research. His question that he was posing for his science fair project, does your cat's butthole really touch all of the surfaces in your home? That was his research for his science fair. So... He conducted experiments at his home with his pet cat, and how did they come up with the answer? Non-toxic lipstick was applied to the cat's, you know, bum hole, and then they were tracked throughout the day. Cats with longer hair, so they did this with multiple cats, apparently. Cats with longer hair did not appear to leave any lipstick smears around the house. But if you have a short-haired cat, they may be lying on a pile of laundry or an unmade bed or other soft, uneven surface, then yes, they may be touching with their bum many of the surfaces in your home. So they discovered that the answer is... yes and no, depending on the type of cat and where that cat likes to lounge around. So now we know. This is important scientific research here. I hope he won his science fair. I hope he won. And lastly, here in the broken news this morning, the odd and unusual side of the headlines, there's this old joke. And I don't know which I've heard a stand-up comedian, and I can't remember who it is, tell this joke. I thought that quicksand would be a much bigger problem in adulthood than it actually turned out to be. When I was a child, you know, you watch all of the cartoons and everything on TV, you'd think quicksand was everywhere, and you'd think this would be a much bigger problem than it actually is in adulthood. But the threat is not zero. Mitchell O'Brien, his name, a gentleman that got stuck in a pit of quicksand while attempting to go fishing at Lake Michigan. But there is a twist to this story. He's okay. He said it was like something was holding my left leg underground. He stepped in this pond of quicksand, and he couldn't get it out. And Mr. O'Brien ended up waist deep in the quicksand, trying to call 911, and the young lady that he was with, Brianne Sika, with whom the story says he was in that vague hanging out but maybe not officially dating stage at that point in their relationship, right? Just friends, but not really a whole lot more, maybe going to be a whole lot more, but maybe not yet. So anyway, Brianne gets out her phone as well in an effort to get a hold of emergency services. Mr. O'Brien tells the story, we both got through at the same time, and I told the operator, I think my girlfriend is trying to call you as well. And she, at the same time, about 20 feet away, says my boyfriend is stuck in quicksand. As it turns out, that was the first time they had ever used those terms, boyfriend and girlfriend. Speaking to the 911 operator. That was literally the first time we defined our relationship, he said. And it happened with two separate 911 operators at the same time. Eventually, first responders arrived and assisted Mr. O'Brien, removed him from the quicksand, and he was able to return home safely with his now official girlfriend. The story... has a happy... I hope they have a long and healthy relationship, get married, and have kids and grandkids, because that's a story that you will want to tell. For that is going to be a family legend. Here's hoping it all works out. There you go. That is today's Broken News Report, an update on the odd and unusual side of the headlines. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
You want local sports? You've got lots of it at the WFIN Sports Archive. Play or download the Coach's Corner shows, plus games from your favorite teams, the Findlay Trojans, the BBC, and Ottawa Glendorf. You have the power of local sports at your fingertips with the Sports Audio Archive. Check it out by clicking Game Audio Archive under the Sports tab at WFIN.com.
And now, your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. This is a very interesting question, a little morbid perhaps, but a very interesting question. Have you ever given any thought to what you would choose for your last meal? It would be the last meal. If you knew it was going to be your last meal, what would you choose? Choice Mutual created a report analyzing Americans' answers to this question. And they broke it down state by state, keeping in mind that there were ties in many states. So when we tell you how many states chose each one, it will actually add up to more than 50 because there were a number of ties. But they broke it down state by state. And there were some surprises here. At least to me, there were some surprises. In 28 states, the number one answer overall, tops in 28 states, steak. That would be our last meal. If we could choose what it was, we knew it was going to be our last. 28 states said steak would be the top meal. But then, right behind that, potatoes. Now, you would think that kind of goes together, steak and potatoes. But in 10 states, potatoes was actually the number one answer. So, again, I'm assuming you would want potatoes as a side dish, but in 10 states, it was number one ahead of what one would presume would be the main dish. So, I don't know, that was just a bit of a surprise. 10 more states, including Ohio, selected pasta above all else. So, in Ohio, pasta was the top answer for the final meal. And I guess that could be any kind of pasta. They didn't break it down specifically by dish, just pasta in general. Pizza, which I would think would be higher up on the list, was the top pick of only 5 states. And so it was actually number 4 overall. I would have guessed certainly higher than pasta. I would have guessed, you know, higher than pasta, but... but no, just 5 states picked pizza overall. Maine was the only state where burgers topped the list. Okay. I would have to agree with that. I mean, burgers, I love a good burger. But if it was going to be my last meal ever, I think I would want something a little more special than a burger. But in Maine, that was the number one. And there is only one state, Maryland, that would pick veggies, was at the top of the response list in Maryland. Again, they did not break it down as to which vegetables, but veggies is the top response in Maryland. Wow. That is a big surprise. They also asked what would be your last drink, your last beverage. And wine was America's top choice for final beverage. Ohio was included in the number of states that would pick wine with their meal, their last beverage. Just plain old water came in second place, followed by tea, and then beer. Tea outranking beer as a final beverage. Again, if you're going to go out with a bang. But people are pick tea rather than beer. Let's see here. I like this in Oregon in terms of final beverage. In Oregon, they say a final cocktail would be the way to cap it all off. And in Nebraska, they selected milk as their final beverage. So, again, a little weird. Veggies and milk. Would that be your final meal? But it was right up there. So, anyway, something to think about, I guess. What would your final meal be if you knew it was going to be your final meal and had to could pick anything? What would it be? Not veggies and milk, I can tell you that. Time to get an update on what's happening. The Findlay-Hancock County Public Library. Sarah Clevedens is here, and actually not a whole lot in the month of May. Month of May typically is a little bit like getting ready for summer read and all of that.
So. Absolutely. We're so excited for the theme this year. It's an art theme, Color Your World. So
oh, okay. All
that
right.
Should be a lot of fun.
Yeah. This is going to be fun. When does that get underway? It's hard to believe that we're already starting to talk about summer read.
I know summer read is in June and July.
Okay,
one of our biggest events for May though is Art Walk.
Right,
which feels like a great precursor to that art themed summer read.
Exactly. So, what have you got going on for Art Walk?
For Art Walk, we will have our tiny art show, as well as community art submitted by local schools. We'll have performances. By Liberty Benton's Fermata the Blue. And oh gosh, I apologize to the other school whom I just slipped out of my mind, but we'll have two great student performances that night. And then our friends at the library will also be having their annual book sale.
Okay. That is an important fundraiser, obviously, for the operations. And that kind of leads to one of the things that we did want to talk about this morning, because it's been very much in the news. Both at the state and the federal level about library funding. Mm-hmm. When the House passed its version of the state budget a couple of weeks ago or so, there was a lot of discussion over library funding. This became a big issue. And I know the libraries statewide were able to claw back some funding. Talk a little bit about the way this works for libraries in the state of Ohio.
Sure. So currently, libraries in Ohio are funded through the Public Library Fund, which is a percentage of the general revenue fund.
Yeah.
So 1.7% of the state's general revenue is distributed to all 88 counties, and then at the county level, distributed to all the libraries that serve part of that county. What the House passed in their version of the budget changes public library funding. So it eliminates the public library fund as we know it. It would no longer be a percentage and instead becomes a line item in the state budget, which really sort of drastically alters that partnership, that very long partnership we've had with the state to be able to have this consistent, reliable funding coming from the state for our public libraries.
The argument for changing it from a percentage of the budget to a specific set amount is that it is a definite amount of funding as opposed to an unknown amount of funding. You may think you get a 1.7% of the budget, you may think it's going to be X amount, but if revenues come in lower, then you get lower. If it's a line item, you would get a set amount regardless.
Sure, but if it's a percentage and revenues come in higher, we also
more. Fair enough.
And in Hancock County, a couple of years where that happened are what allowed us to set aside the funds to just do the updates that we've done at our main branch with the fresh paint, carpet, reorganizing our spaces.
So what does that mean moving forward? I mean, what is your anticipation that this means moving forward in the next 2-year budget cycle? Because it could be changed back. So we're only talking right now. We're talking about the here and now, the next 2-year budget cycle. What do you expect from those 2 years?
Yeah. So, first we'll say we're early in the budget process. Still, we've seen the governor's proposal, which really continue to support libraries. We've seen the House proposal that we are much less excited about, and we still have the Senate proposal to come.
Yeah.
And then conference committee, and then it goes to the governor's.
There's
desk.
A lot that has.
There's
to
a
happen.
Lot of steps that have to happen. I think many of us in the library world are more concerned about what happens 2 years from now. If we are no longer a priority, an identified priority, a percentage of the state budget, what does that mean when we're in this place in 2 years?
Yeah.
We go down to the State House every year and talk about all the great work libraries do every 2 years when that's the budget process. We're really mm-hmm. advocating to maintain our percentage as a fund. So, you know, we are constantly fighting for our funding, but it's just going to be a much more difficult fight going forward.
And as we mentioned, that advocacy was to a certain extent successful because you did claw back, the Library Association did claw back some funding. You got more than what originally was proposed in the House version of the budget.
Right. And the original proposal in the House version also drastically altered the way those funds were distributed to counties, which would have been significant.
So how big of a percentage is that state funding for what you do at the Findlay-Hancock County Public Library? Because here's the other question. We've heard about eliminating funds for libraries being eliminated at the federal level as part of the whole government efficiency movement. Does that have a bearing on what you do at the local level?
So first, for our library, we receive about 66% of our revenue in 2024 was public library funds.
Okay.
Another 22% is our local levy. Mm-hmm. And then we have investments, gifts, friends of the library that make up the difference. Federally speaking, FHCPL does not receive money directly from the Institute for Museum and Library Services.
Okay.
However, IMLS does have a grants to state program, and a significant amount of funds go to the State Library of Ohio. At the State Library of Ohio, those funds support grants. And again, FHCPL does not currently have a grant pending, but our Traverse, that is our outreach vehicle, was paid for by
We have utilized that in the past.
And also significant in Ohio is the amazing partnerships that we have in place. The Ohio Digital Library is a key example, and that has significant funding from that grants to state program. So federal funding could impact the Ohio Digital Library, which could impact all Ohioans.
So there is a trickle-down effect even
there. Absolutely is.
Have there been discussions about if the funding is cut, and again, as we have said, there are a lot of steps that have to happen before all of this is set in stone, but if cuts have to be made, where those cuts might end up being?
There are so many moving parts. We have not put pen to paper and said we will make change X, Y, or Z if this particular scenario plays out. We know that the vast majority of our expenditures are staff salary benefits and materials. And so if we had to make some sort of significant cuts down the road, those would be the areas that would be impacted.
Yeah, but that's not even because I'm sure that you've had questions. Does this mean that, I don't know, the Arlington branch might go away, or the bookmobile might go away, all of these types of things, and it's just too soon to
Soon to tell. But I can tell you that, librarians love research. We love our statistics, our facts, and so we would closely look at how to balance our budget with the preserving as many services as we could for our patrons.
We'll continue to watch this as it goes through the process, but to put some perspective on it for folks who have heard the stories about library funding and as that relates to the state budget and the kind of impact that has, it's good information for people to know.
Well, and I do want to say a big thank you to all of our patrons in the community and statewide. Our libraries put out a call and asked all of our patrons to reach out to their representatives and share their stories of what the libraries mean to them. And those were very impactful.
Yeah. Again,
thank you.
Sarah Klebanitz, the Findlay-Hancock County Public Library, with us this morning. Remind about Art Walk. That's the big thing coming up in the next month. And an opportunity for folks to visit the library and find out what all of the excitement is about.
Absolutely.
Sarah, thanks very much for dropping by.
Thank you.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us on the program this morning. Remember, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the show at our webpage, and that is goodmornings.net. Coming up tomorrow on the program, a new report from the AARP Fraud Watch Network reveals how some common digital habits could have users vulnerable and emphasizes the importance of the newly formed National Elder Fraud Coordination Center. We'll learn more. So until tomorrow morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.